Welcome to Shifting Power Through Feminisms, a podcast series born from the African Feminisms Gathering held in Johannesburg in September 2025. Over 4 days, feminists from across the continent and across generations came together through ritual, art, activism, and dialogue to reimagine power, challenge injustice, and build futures grounded in care, creativity, and collective strength. This podcast doesn't recount the gathering, it continues its conversations. In the 3 episodes, we explore how African feminists are responding to a time of polycrisis, how well-being and healing shape sustainable movements, and how men can engage meaningfully as allies in feminist struggles. These episodes carry forward the spirit of the gathering's core themes: rights, representation, and resources, while inviting listeners into the ongoing work of shifting power through feminisms. So let's keep the conversation moving.
Hello. Thank you, Brenda, for being here.
Thank you, Marilyn, for the invite.
So today we're here as part of the African Feminisms Project of the House of African Feminisms that's run by the Goethe Institute. And we're having a conversation on African feminisms and the poly crisis. And remember talking to you about this. And I think for me, one of the reasons why this conversation is particularly important and why I wanted you as a conversationalist on this is because the poly crisis has been framed as this overarching, all-encompassing thing that somehow is supposed to be the frame through which we both view the world and live the world. Mm-hmm. And as African feminists, I think one of the things we always do is we question who's framing, mm-hmm. and how does this framing, how does it see us? Where's our agency? Where are we located? So that's a conversation we're going to have today. But before we have that, perhaps we should just introduce ourselves.
Yes.
So I'm Marilyn Kamuru. I'm a Kenyan feminist. I'm a writer, a lawyer by training because it comes up, but not so much in practice. And I am excited to be having this conversation with Brenda Wamboi.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. My name is Brenda Wamboi. I'm a policy actor, or like I'm trained in policy with a history in media, actually, or a background in media and comms, new media, as well as business. But like, when have I done that? Yeah. And also a Kenyan feminist, a friend to Marilyn, conversational partner to Marilyn as well. Really interested in talking about this topic because I'm interested in framing whose crisis this is, right? Because it has become a crisis now, it has a poly crisis, right?
Yes.
Why now? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why now? Who does it concern? And just basically placing us in the conversation so that we can have some form of agency, as you've said, and identify possible actions or, you know, possible ways to move from here.
Fantastic. Thank you. So Brenda hasn't said that she's also a political strategist par excellence. So I'm going to add that in there. I think that's also something that's important because I think it helps people understand how we view this this framing of crises. So when we're talking about the poly crisis, what immediately comes to mind for you?
For me, it's everything everywhere all at once, like the movie. Mm-hmm. Only that it's not just happening separately, right?
Yes.
These crises are all co-occurring and they exacerbate each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they are more like individually, if you thought about like climate change by itself, like we could all focus on climate change, but then it's happening alongside geopolitical struggles. It's happening alongside the movement of national politics to, you know, populist movements.
Yes.
On the economic front, we have stagflation, you know, so it's multiple things happening at the same time, which make it impossible to say this is the one thing that we're going to focus on. This is the one thing that all of us are going to look at. So it's not like, I know people have spoken a lot about this on social media. It's not like the time that we had to close the hole in the ozone layer, right?
Oh, gosh, yes. I forgot about that. Yeah? Yes.
And we were all focused on
that
hole.
Yep.
And that hole occupied, I speak about that hole because it occupied such a big, you know, like a big space, like in our psyche, as for me as a millennial, like we knew we were dying. And
right?
We're going to die.
Yeah.
And the climate crisis, for example, that we have now is orders of magnitude worse than that. Than that hole in the ozone layer, which we have done a really good job at closing. So you can see that, like, we just have a sense of, I'd say, helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
It can inspire cynicism. I wouldn't say that cynicism is the default posture, but
yep.
It just feels larger than life. Like, if you're going to start addressing it, where do we start mm-hmm. addressing it? Every day we have new problems. You know, you get on Twitter, for example, and then you see, oh, today they taught those robot dogs. You know, those robot dogs.
Yes.
Those robot dogs in California. Like, oh, they've taught them. And you're like, oh, just another day. You know,
mm-hmm.
and then tomorrow mm-hmm. it'll be some new stuff. Like, oh, Hurricane Melissa has done. Like,
yes.
So it's escalating every day. It occupies a really big part in our psyche. And we feel like we have limited power to act, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you add this to the already existing power structures that we have, one of the biggest is patriarchy, obviously,
right?
Which is the domination of women using male-centered or male-focused structures. So the extraction of labor, the extraction, just it's a very extractive system
right.
that puts women at the bottom and, you know, takes away from them at the or builds things at their expense. So polycrisis will definitely affect women differently,
right?
Than everybody else.
And I think it's interesting because you speak about it and immediately you spoke in global terms, right? And I think for me why that's a little interesting is for a long time, Africa has sort of been crisis central, right? You know, we were used to this perception, this very, you know, Western's perception of Africa as a home of crisis. You
yes.
know, I'm thinking in my head, I've just got that. Oh God, do you remember that Michael Jackson, We Are the World thing?
Yes,
you know,
yes.
like this, and you're going to see Brenda and I's age gaps because of some of the examples we'll use. But, you know, so this framing of us as this continent of crises, right? Like things are always happening. And for me, I think what's interesting about that in this moment is as Africans, and especially as African feminists, we have sort of a familiarity with crisis,
yes,
and with crisis language that other people in the world don't have. It doesn't incapacitate us in the same way because for so long we have been incorrectly viewed
yes.
and pathologized ourselves as crisis. Like it's almost our entire existence itself was a crisis, right?
Yes.
You know, you look at these pictures and you're kind of like, okay, I know that's a part of Ethiopia, or I know that's a part of Nigeria, or a part of Kenya, but that's not all of Kenya, or all of Ethiopia, or all of Nigeria. You know, so we have a sense of the complexity of our existence beyond crisis, and I think a way that many other parts of the world haven't had, because the polycrisis has sort of, it's evolved slowly, but it's like we've now reached boiling point, as you've said, you know, this place of I actually do think the cynicism is setting in. I think I might differ with you a little bit there. Mm. Although I also think that's a bit of a generational thing. I think we've had this discussion.
Yes.
You know, the sense of helplessness and a lack of agency because there's so many things and what do we do now? But for me, what I'm interested in is how are African feminists engaging with this moment? And how is it different? Than how we were engaging, you know, let's say even a decade ago or two decades ago, you know, are there differences for you? I mean, I know you've been super active in this space for a long time, but are you seeing differences?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think key to the entire conversation is the role of technology. And the same way we talk about, for example, climate change as an exacerbating factor of all other crises, I'd say is the same way we talk about technology, only that technology offers more opportunities, right? So we don't have as much, we are able to correct narratives about ourselves almost immediately, right?
Yep.
So as soon as the narrative arises or it comes to surface, we can correct it on, at least we can do it on social media, right? So there's that, and that allows transnational conversation, not just continent-wide and even across continents, right?
Yeah.
So we are in conversation, for example, one of the most important conversations I've seen happen across the African continent was total shutdown.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Total shutdown was, and still is.
Is, yeah.
Because it continues. A very not just a movement, but a conversation across borders, right? So
yep.
we have that transnational solidarity on areas such as violence against women. Then we also have country-specific movements, for example, like NSARS, right? Which is a movement about police violence, which is state violence. But then state violence will always have a feminized angle or a feminized face to an extent, right? And then there's also the refusal, I'd say, of respectability politics. Yeah, the internet allows people to just say no to decorum as a demand. And that's one key difference that we've seen. In the past, it was possible, for example, I'll use a very famous Kenyan activist, Nobel Prize winner, Wangari Maathai. It was very possible, it was easy actually, for Daniel Arap Moi to characterize her as a mad woman, right?
Yes.
Because it
yes.
just you need to just clip a couple of, to clip some videos of her and her, like women of her cohort protesting, and you know, tear out her hair and have her look crazy and then come and say, this is, you know, before you hear is a mad woman, and just ensure that she can't get any interviews on mainstream media and, you know, leave her cause up to, you know, just hoping for the best that people have the reasoning to see that Uhuru Park should not be grabbed or, you know, things like this. But now, when you think about platforms, they allow someone like Wangari Maathai, for example, to be able to say, yeah, this is why we are doing this protest at this time.
Yes.
So there's more room. And this is, you'll note, actually something that I have in my notes, just to also take it a bit more global. You'll note that on the economic, like, axis, when you think about the inequality, like wealth inequality, income inequality, all those people, for example, we look at someone like Elon Musk, who's the world's richest man, while benefiting immensely from government subsidies, but they will tend to own a media property.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So he owns Twitter. I refuse to call it X.
Yeah. With you there.
Yeah. So he owns Twitter. Then you come to someone like Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post.
Yes.
Right? So that's mainstream, traditional media. Then we have someone like Larry Ellison, who is said to be in the process of, you know, setting up a JV, that's a joint venture, to buy the TikTok operation in the United States, right? Under national security concerns.
Right.
So there is always, a serious effort by the capital class to engage or to control media because it has offered the powerless, the people who are rendered powerless, an opportunity to influence and dictate the narrative. So those, for me, like technology offers, yes, it's a complicating factor in the polycrisis, but it also offers a new kind of balance of power. And the fact that we get to... people use the internet in strange ways. There's something about the internet is that it is strange. Yeah, so that allows...
It permits strangeness.
Yeah, that allows people to constantly outwit power.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So for me, that's one of the reasons I'm very hopeful. Of course, it's a new site of existing, you know, like technology-facilitated violence against women, for example. You know, anything that exists can be worsened by the internet.
Right.
But then it also offers an opportunity for us, right, as African feminists. So I think it has been a really important tool for feminist organizing. But then we also can tend to mistake the conversation for movement, right? And the conversation is important. But then...
How are we mistaking the conversation for movement?
The same thing that we always... the way... it's a thing that Marilyn and I have discussed. Like, it is possible to dwell at the 1-1. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
So you will permanently be in a state of educating people on the, like, entry level, yeah?
Yes.
This is entry level feminism, this is entry level. And not to say, this is not to deride, all of us entered, had an entry point.
Yep. All of us went through feminism 101.
Exactly. Yes. But then at some point there has to be, you know, building.
Yes.
But then the noisy state of the internet can convince you to spend all your time
there
doing the intro.
Yeah.
So, and I know that nobody, this is not an army where people come and give you like a role and tell you you're a corporal and this is what you're, you know.
Yeah.
I hope there are corporals in the army. I don't know about army structures. But I know there are in the police force, but I don't like talking about the police. So nobody assigns you a role. It just kind of, you know, you self-sort and you self-select. So it's very personal in that sense. But then at some point there has to be an effort, you know. To build.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that's an interesting thing you you bring up. And it's important because it's that sort of... And I think African feminists have really insisted on, I think actually to great success, especially comparing to other parts of the world, on a very flat organizational structure, right? Not creating sort of these celebrity feminists and having feminism be... a movement that allows you to engage where you can, as and when you can. I think about, for instance, like now that we're thinking about even just total shutdown and femicide, I think about a lot of the violence against women work that had been done, and it was almost entirely by NGOs, right? Yes. Non-governmental organizations. And, you know, so it was sort of funded feminism. And I think one of the differences I'm seeing now in spades, partly because of technology, is that there are African feminists all over, everywhere. Very few of them are paid for their feminist work. Most of them, you know, earn a living doing something else. Yes. Artists, you know, TV producer, you know, whatever. And that's also made, I think, African feminism, there's a robustness to it. And so I see a lot of these conversations around funding, you know, so even with a polycrisis, this discussion about, so what does that mean in the wake of, you know, declining funding, USAID, and what we're seeing, you know, indications from the US around funding, especially in health, which we know has a significant impact in Africa, or even the decline of feminist foreign policies, you know. But if African feminists are engaging not from a point of NGOs and grants, that engagement is not going to be affected by funding in the ways that people think it is. And so I think one of the things about the polycrisis for me is it presents opportunities to sort of reveal who is doing the real work, you know, and that's not to say NGOs aren't doing really important work. But I think especially in terms of narratives, as we've talked about, you know, framing, even femicide, you know, the work that Women for Change in South Africa, the total shutdown movement, which has, you know, literally spread across the entire continent, you know, the demands around femicide, all of that has been African feminist work. And even to the extent that it's being, you know, reluctantly adopted by states, the South African government accepted that, you know, femicide should be a national disaster, although they've done this a couple of times without any real change in state policy. In Kenya, we're still asking for that. But again, I think, and I was thinking about that this morning, I was like, okay, so what are we hoping for when they say that it's a national disaster, when we say that it's a crisis? We're winning the framing conversation. Yes. We're agenda setting, definitely. I think that's one of the things that I think African feminists really are doing better than anybody else on the continent, including political actors on the continent. Yes. In fact, if you want to get political strategists for your campaign, you should look for them from African feminists. Because, I mean, I think the work that we've done on the continent about setting the agenda, ensuring that it's having the discussion is framed in the way that we believe it should be framed, and given our very different power and lack of institutional sort of foundation is incredibly impressive. So yeah, tell me what are you thinking?
So we're just gonna go all over the place, right? Because I have so many thoughts on what you just shared. So to begin with, we all know this is it's a view I hold. I know this is a view that Maylin holds. There is no Ruto must go in 2024 that looks the way it does. Like, it would have happened, definitely. Yes. But it wouldn't have looked the way it did without Enfemicide in January 2024, right? Yep. So this is Enfemicide KE.
Yep.
So we have seen...
So we're speaking about the Kenyan context and... Yeah. Yep. So just a little background so that the viewers across the continent...
So we have a distributed protest that happens across counties. This is, at this scale, we haven't seen anything like that in Kenya before.
Yep.
And it was leaderless, right? Which also reduces the impetus for people to, you know, gain celebrity.
Yep.
And also reduces surface area for state targeting,
yes.
Right? And as a result, we then come to June 2024. So Enfemicide protests start the year in 2024. And then in June 2024, we have a series of rolling protests, right? Initially about the finance bill, then they become about state violence, and just basically the illegitimate Kenyan state. So this is one of the ways, as Maylin is saying, that Kenyan feminists or even African feminists have been influencing and winning the framing, framing war, I'll call
yes.
it. Because in politics, everything is high stakes,
yes.
And we're always fighting. And then the second thing I thought about this last night as I was thinking about what I wanted to share, is that there is no violence that hasn't been sanctioned or is not being condoned by the state.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about, and this is just me as a political scientist, one of the things that we tell people is that the state has a monopoly on violence,
yes.
right? So if the state has a monopoly on violence, any violence that is occurring that is not being, and this is not to say that the state should,
yes, deploy it.
Should deploy
yes.
violence, right?
Yes.
But any violence that is occurring that the state is not conducting is either like a result of state failure
yes.
or is being incentivized by the state or
yep.
condoned by the state. The state has something to do with
yes.
this, right?
Yes.
So what is the worst form of violence that happens to women? It's femicide,
yes.
right?
Yes.
So there is, you know, maiming, harming, there is assault, and then the sexual assault, and then there is, you know, as we move up, right?
Yes.
And then it ends in the death of women because they are women,
right?
Gendered violence.
Yes.
So anytime we have, and how many movements against femicide do we have on this continent?
Yeah.
Quite a number,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I'm not going to cite a number because I haven't counted them, but I know we have them in at least 10 countries. So these are African countries failing to the extent that violence has been deployed against women.
Mm-hmm.
Like they are being killed
yes.
because they are women. It has been recognized that this is
yep.
This is a national crisis.
Right.
And to me, this is the worst manifestation of polycrisis on women's bodies. Then we also have like lower manifestations like autoimmune disorders. So we
yes.
have mostly data from the United States because
yep.
they collect a lot of health
mm-hmm.
Data. But in their country, I think women are 4 times likelier to have an autoimmune disorder, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is usually, we are still collecting data, of course, because women are understudied
right.
because of medical misogyny.
Yes.
But, you know, high cortisol, i.e. the stress hormone, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Carrying more, like, in terms of labor. So there's, you know, working,
yes.
because you're working probably
emotional labor, yep.
And then coming to work a second shift
mm-hmm.
at home. So when we now complicate it, come back to the African context, you remember something that you said about having existed in this crisis,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
and these images, you know, so how many we know the fly, you know, the fly, you
yes,
know
the picture with a yeah. fly, yes, of course,
is
who
it
doesn't
the,
know that
is
picture?
It the UNICEF fly, who's
yes.
fly is it? But one of those flyers, you know, so we have, you know, those images,
yeah,
and we know that like women going to fetch water,
yes,
and then they came to realize,
and they're always dirty, right?
Of course,
yes, yes,
yeah, so
mm-hmm.
we have these images and these narratives that make it like it's acceptable for African women and African people
yes.
to suffer.
Yeah.
So it's not that we are saying that this is an unacceptable level of crisis or violence
mm-hmm.
for Africans,
yes.
for African women. It's for everybody else.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So even as we say that we want to solve polycrisis, like
yes.
once it becomes, once we reach
yes.
an acceptable level of violence
yes.
or an acceptable level of crisis,
yep.
we'll just be back to the UNICEF
we'll be
fly.
Back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's okay. And it'll be
yeah.
like, yeah, we are singing We Are the World version
yeah.
2.
And again, this is because
yeah.
of what we've said with, you know, where African feminists are sort of the canaries in the coal mine.
Mm.
So when we are saying, hey, guys, there's a real problem.
Yeah.
No one wants to pay attention until now.
Yeah.
Here we are, you know, because the women fetching water
yeah.
was indications of the climate crisis.
Yes.
Those were the earliest indications of the climate crisis, right? We're having to walk farther to fetch
mm.
water. We can't find firewood. So this we're cutting down trees and, you know, then we have Wangari Maathai. So we see the development and almost, in fact, in some ways,
mm-hmm.
the articulation of these global crises are coming from the global South
yes.
experience, but then they're being co-opted and the language is then repackaged and given back to us. So we are now, we are participants of a crisis that we actually discovered.
Yeah.
You know, so there's also an enormous amount of epistemic violence
yes.
in this framing, right? Because we're being told that we are experiencing a crisis as if we didn't know.
And I think something else, just so that I don't forget, you remember when you spoke about, I've been, Maylin knows, I've been very delusionally optimistic recently, I think. This is the second podcast I think I'm discussing this on, or second conversation of this sort. But just to be charitable to feminism that occurred, or like 90s feminism, 2000s feminism that happened mostly via NGOs, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like the tools, they use the tools they had, and of course, yes, maybe they have been outlived. But then one of the pitfalls, I'd say, of the reduction in funding, because right now one of the things that polycrisis allows is for states like the United States, which, you know, people think they're being kind by giving the amount of development aid they do, yet that just maintains the power structures as they are, right?
Yes.
But then the narrative of polycrisis allows for large swathes of money mm-hmm. to be taken away from
yes.
programs, right?
Yep.
And be redirected.
Yes.
So when you are in an environment of crisis, and I'm just going to like bring it back to the feminist movement, now we have authoritarianism, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all know our favorite orange man in that country.
Yes.
And, you know, he'll wake up and declare this, declare that, the other. So authoritarianism is rising. Then we have privatization that's
yep.
increasing.
Mm-hmm.
In Kenya, we have a privatization bill at the moment that we have to fight. You know, we have to fight every day. Yeah, we wake
yes.
up every day and fight.
Yes.
So we had the seeds, the bill that was preventing people from saving and sharing.
And sharing indigenous seeds. Yes.
Seeds.
Yes.
Food,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that enables privatization. We have authoritarianism. And then we also have this this power structure or this permission structure that allows people to be disciplined, you know,
mm-hmm.
right? So the state is able to say, can't you see we have real problems?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
These are not, what you're doing is
yeah.
not, is not real, right? And there's already like an environment of scarcity. So when we think about the feminist movement then, right, in as much as it was NGOized,
yep.
It allowed for sustained progress, because for people like myself who, for example, are not being paid to do this work,
yes,
it's competing with what I do to put food on my table,
right?
Right. So we
yes.
might currently, like, we might be put in a state of always responding and always, because we always have time for protest, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we go and we'll march, you know.
Yes.
Okay, no, we don't only, I'm not trying to, you
yep.
know, reduce their importance,
yes.
but then what happens after that needs sustained organizing, needs to be
right.
supported, needs to be funded. And so the existence of NGOs was as a result of state failure. And it's not that the state has stopped failing. It,
yes.
has, it has become expected, right?
Yeah.
In
yes.
fact, it's become expected to the state where, like, states that have never that never used to fail have started failing. You
or
know?
They're failing in areas that they
yeah.
never used to fail in, like education
failing.
In Kenya.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and then now we add one of the worst complicating factors. I have a friend who constantly says that he thinks it's criminal that we don't have a COVID-19 pandemic Memorial Day. Like,
mm.
so just something that has disrupted our lives, right?
Yes.
Continues to
yes.
disrupt our lives.
Yeah.
We're kind of forgetting it.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Literally happened, what?
Yes.
It started in December 2019.
Yep.
Effects mostly started being
mm-hmm.
felt worldwide in 2020. Shifted how we interact
yes.
socially, how we
yeah.
do things. That's how short a time it takes us to forget. So now
mm-hmm.
we can imagine without sustained like structures that are dedicated to, you know, holding that space, creating that space.
Right.
Right? So we can just tend to be in that one, you know, like a responsive, a reactive. And I'm not trying to, like, the willingness of people to protest is amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. I like that organizing.
Yeah.
The participation, I'd say, the organizing capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But then to defeat these systems that we're up against, it needs to be sustained. And unfortunately, one of the ways that we've been able to sustain movements has been NGOs.
Has,
right?
But
so maybe
I'm going to challenge you
yeah.
here, because I think maybe that's one of the other challenges for African feminists,
mm.
I think. And I think even one of the challenges I saw with the protests, and I'm going to try really hard not to call them that generational term, because I think the protests were so much more than
yes.
that. And I think that the use of, I will use it just for the explanation,
yeah.
the use of Gen Z protests was a way to try and reduce the universality
mm.
of the discontent
yes.
in Kenya. And we've seen these protests around the world as well, right? And even though they are being dubbed Gen Z protests, they're generally majoritarian in nature. They're
mm.
not generational. So my challenge to you is that we have been defined
mm.
by resistance.
Mm.
In some ways, it's sort of like we've forgotten what we've been fighting for.
Yeah.
So we're stuck still strategizing battles because we don't seem to have both a vision of winning the war,
mm-hmm.
but also a vision of what's happening afterwards, right? Like, I think about Kiguro and
mm.
how he used to ask us when he was on Twitter, you know, how are you imagining freedom today?
Mm.
And for me, I think one of the most important and most radical things you have to do when you're living, especially as an African feminist, is you have to keep the power of your imagination.
Yes.
Because sometimes it really is overwhelming. And so I'm going to challenge you, because this framing of constantly reacting, I think is designed to keep us in this perpetual loop where we're never actually transcending.
Yes.
And even just, even if we're sort of restructuring another version of the state that may require restructuring itself, it might fail in some ways, we're never actually seeking to dismantle.
Yes.
And I for me, that's one of the things that I've found a bit problematic about this polycrisis framing, is that it distracts us from dismantling the structures, the very oppressive structures that we're talking about.
Oh, no, I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with you. So for me, one of my, like, my key academic, like, pet subject is state failure, right? Hopefully when I do my doctorate. state capacity and state failure, because I'm generally an optimistic person, because for as long as we insist on being organized in states, they must work.
Yes.
Right? They have to work.
Yep.
So for me, just working from the ground up, like, so we have states. Right? We have states to enable us to live or coexist. Then we have social contracts. So are these states fulfilling their social contracts across the board?
No.
Right?
Yes.
No. And then now it's not only like national issues, it becomes geopolitical, because states have to interact with each other. Then we have this like conflict ridden, like a matrix. It's just so chaotic.
Yes.
So at the end of the day, as you've said, the crisis distracts us from the fact that these states are not working, right? The states are not working. They have managed to allow funneling of resources to a very small group of people.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
The idea, I know this is a common thing to say on socials, but the idea of billionaires is abhorrent. Yeah? It's abhorrent. And what do they do with their wealth? Like, they mostly make it in tech now, right? They mostly make it in tech. And then they decide they want to go to space. and then they buy a media company.
Yeah.
That's just like... That is a lack of imagination. So you have this like widening inequality. The state is unable to.
Yes.
And this is why, just to bring in yet another movement that I like, the tax justice movement is so necessary. And I wish they had more airtime. Yeah. It's just everybody should pay tax, and people, wealthy people should pay more tax, like, or a proportionate income. We should have, you know, redistribution. We need a material redistribution
right?
Of resources. And that's why you look at the wins that are celebrated or that are allowed to be celebrated, and they are never material wins, right? Like material gains, right? And even when material gains are made, they are obscured. So you think about International Women's Day, for example, now becoming a celebration of women as opposed to, you know, the original celebration of women, like women's labor, right?
Yeah.
So any labor movements become cute, you know. They always tend to take away from those like material gains that have been won, right?
Yeah.
By now, even who is it? Is it Milton Friedman or one of those economists who expected us to have a 4-day work week, like as standard, right?
Right.
And yet people are still working more than ever, earning less than ever. You know, adjusted for inflation, it's a crisis. Right? It's a manifestation of this crisis to continue funneling money to a small elite capital class and and states that don't work.
Let's go back to that word. Is it a crisis, or is it working exactly as it's intended to?
Yes, it's working exactly as it was designed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, again, you know, the use of this term, and sometimes, in fact, I've been thinking how I have to revise a whole chapter I wrote in my book, because I talk about the constitutional crisis in Kenya with our parliament being unconstitutional, which it has been since, you know, 2010. Or maybe 2014, 15, if you want to be nice. And I think the challenge with converting ordinary quotidian experiences into crisis language in the past was meant to engender support for urgent response, right?
Yes.
Like the ozone, the hole in the ozone, like you were talking about. But it seems like what's happening is, in an attempt to maybe dilute our impact, this language and this framing now is really just to keep us stuck.
Yes.
It's no longer doing, it's no longer playing the role that it used to play, which is galvanize support. Let's work on this issue. Let's make sure that we've made 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps. And after that, we can then maybe say, okay, it's dropped down from crisis. We can focus on the next one. So I think we need to actually, the more I've been thinking about this, I think I was mentioning to you how Jennifer Nash, who's a Black American feminist, speaks about crisis, and she talks about how it really does sometimes, we use the language of crisis, but it's a framing that we're trying to enlist some sort of engagement urgent, but it really is, it's sort of ordinary. It is the response. You know, if you're not going to have employment, if you are going to tax people to the point where they can't afford to live, then they protest. Mm-hmm. That's not a crisis. That is the expected response. That's a normal response to your policies, right? To government policies. So there's a way in which this language of crisis is also invisibilizing the state, right? And you're talking very passionately and importantly about state. It's almost like deliberate incapacity, right? But that deliberate incapacity is then being invisibilized by this language of crisis, because crisis we share, right? Like we're all equally responsible somehow. There's something, you don't say the state, the Kenyan state has a crisis in education. We talk about an education crisis in Kenya. We're all sharing it. I'm not the one who's deciding on capitation,
right?
I'm not reducing that. So there's a way this language is also invisibilizing the perpetrators of the real violence. And that's not to say I know what we should, you know, we should use instead, but it's to say that we really do need to challenge the use of some of these terms and even our adoption of them if we're trying to further certain goals. Okay, I'm not sure where I was going with that, but
I love that point because it also offers us false binaries or false choices, right? Mm-hmm. Because in crisis, you're able to tell people it's either, you know, we privatize all these things, or we run out of money.
Yes.
And why are those the only things we can do?
Right.
You know, so that allows, especially when you have bad actors, right? Which politics tends to attract bad actors, right? So you have bad actors in power, and then they use the auspices.
And we seem to have the worst right now.
Exactly. They use the auspices of crisis to force us into really bad situations. And just to bring us back to, like, whose crisis, what crisis? So when we think about food and food insecurity, for example, right? It's unconscionable for a country like Kenya. I know we are 80% arid and semi-arid, but still, it is unconscionable for a country like us to be undergoing food insecurity. And yet this is as a result of how states, and I'll say not just Kenya, you know, many African countries, how states were set up at colonialism, right? So we have cash crop colonialism. Here we are, we are busy growing. I love coffee, so this is not an attack on coffee.
At all.
But yeah, so we grow cash crops, right? We have a focus on coffee, on tea, and other cash crops that are basically funneled out of this country. Most Kenyans will know that we drink dregs. Like the tea leaves we are left with here are dregs, right? They're not the best. Kenyan tea, go and have it somewhere else, Go and have it in England and tell me you don't like, you know? So they take away, we have this focus on cash crops. They take away the best of them because they have to earn money.
Right.
And then, you know, we have land theft, right? We have people who, scientists, sorry, and people working in ecology who have been talking about conservancies and their harmful nature, how they're being used to take away land from indigenous groups, right?
Yes.
And then we
yes.
have the climate disaster. And this is hitting African countries and other global South countries unfairly, or, you know, they haven't contributed, right?
Yeah.
They haven't,
yeah.
they've contributed barely nothing because they're not industrialized.
Yeah.
To these emissions. These are global emissions that are causing crisis, like Hurricane Melissa in Jamaica. Then we have economic hardship, which is the global economy working exactly as it's supposed to work.
Right.
You know, so with your Bretton Woods institutions coming to make you basically, you
poorer.
Know. Yeah, you will, like, to banish you into a permanent state of poverty. And then now we have, you know, the perpetual, you know, every political scientist's favorite topic, our democratic rollback. But were these countries ever created, quote unquote, with the borders that we have upon independence, were they ever supposed to succeed, right? Were they given much of a chance at success, right? The hardware we are running is still colonial hardware. So,
to some extent, though.
Yes, not fully.
Yeah.
But, like, imagine if you have a computer. I don't know, find me, like, an old, one of those old white yes. machines from yeah. the 90s.
The one and then with you're the floppies.
Like, what we are going to load on this machine is Windows 11. You know?
Okay, okay.
What we are going to load on this machine.
But
you know,
on that one, I'm going to yeah. push back, because I actually think one of the ways in which African countries mm-hmm. and Asian countries have a real edge over Western European countries mm-hmm. and the United States is that we've had to evolve our yes. state structures, our state systems a couple of times. We've rewritten constitutions.
Yes.
We've tried to remake ourselves. Mm. We've engaged in that introspection, and we don't have this sort of reverence for our past as,
yes.
you know, I mean, I always hear the United States and people comparing us to the United States, and I'm like, our constitution is significantly better than theirs,
yes.
you know, so please don't compare us. Mm. You know, we are eons ahead. We have a gender quota. Mm. They're still trying to make sure that they have equal rights, and they're, you know, not succeeding. So I think we've had an opportunity to rethink and remake. And in that way, I do feel like one of the challenges we have in this moment is that we're talking across each other,
mm-hmm.
that there are some groups around the world of people who actually, because they've done it, are actually more open to the fact that, you know, you can change the state.
Yes.
Because we've done it before, right? You know, I know millennials and Gen Zs get so irritated by this, but I'm going to pull it out. You know, we got rid of Moi, right?
Yeah.
Not that I was part of that generation, but yeah, we got rid of Moi. So we undid a thing and we remade the state. The Moi state is...
It seemed inevitable.
For all intents, it seemed inevitable.
Yeah.
And for all intents and purposes, it's gone. I know people want to keep saying Moi's back. And I always say, I never want us to do that. Like, talk about this element from our history seems to be coming back. Mm. But when you talk about this is back, there's a sense of permanence and inevitability you give it, and a power that it actually doesn't have, right? So I think I was just saying that to say that we're having conversations about the same crises, but for some of us, our experience of change and of state capacity and our ability to change the state is very different vis-a-vis the people who, quote unquote, think that they're ahead, who actually have the least experience. I mean,
yes.
we're watching Americans, and they don't bother to come to Africa to look for experts on how to respond to authoritarianism.
Mm.
They believe in the last couple of years, they have enough expertise,
yeah.
right? And that's not to say we are the experts on it. We're just saying that we've lived through some of these things. We've done, and we've successfully undone some of these things.
Mm.
And if there's going to be some sort of global solidarity around this, you really have to concede that we have knowledge that you do not have. The
yes.
same way we've conceded sometimes, you have knowledge we don't have, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're citing their medical data because it's credible, it's there, we don't have it. So are we going to have difficulty organizing if we can't see past some of the real differences in our state experiences, but also in our capacities?
I think for me, one of the most radicalizing moments was when I discovered Latin American movements, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was around 2016 or 2017, thereabouts, when I just, I don't know, for some reason, became curious. And this is one of the problems because of language bias, but
mm-hmm.
you know, thank goodness for, you know, translating software and websites.
Yes.
But one of the ways we are unable to have south-to-south conversations, which is a small barrier in the age of technology,
yeah.
is language differences,
mm-hmm.
yeah? And
mm-hmm.
I think that is a byproduct of colonialism
right? Yes.
But nonetheless, looking at what Latin Americans have done, given that the Global North meddles there professionally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We think we see meddling here.
Yeah.
They meddle there professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Latin American movements are some of the most resilient.
Yes.
Globally.
Yes.
Right. Then we look at Asia and just the population, right? Because
yep.
there's no arguing with the Asian population, especially
mm-hmm.
in two countries, that's China and India.
Yep.
Where they're able to produce for, like, the domestic market is
yes.
the key, you know.
Yes, it's the key
consumer,
market. Yep.
Yeah, is the
yeah.
key, is the key market.
It's also their
right?
focus,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So they're able to have an inward focus. Latin
yes.
Americans are able to have an inward focus.
Yep.
And I think right now, as an African continent,
mm-hmm.
That's what, that lens, right?
Yes.
That inward focus that we are worth focusing on.
Yeah.
That's something that we can see from our siblings across the mm-hmm. global south.
Yeah.
And so maybe as for people like us, as public intellectuals, as people who are helping, you know, the conversation along, citing or leaning on voices from these continents, these countries, is something that we should prioritize in as much as, you know, we also prioritize talking. Like, so we are talking to people on the African continent, mm-hmm. but perhaps we also need to start cross-pollinating.
Yeah.
And I don't know, because I just tend to have a very optimistic approach, just seeing the movements, because they're not separate or disparate. In Kenya, for example, with End Femicide and the Ruto Must Go, you know, we have so many names for that movement. What would we call it? You know, so we'll just call it Ruto Must Go, because he mm-hmm. must. So seeing the cross-pollination between that. So it's okay for movements to be advocating for different things, but then the cross-pollination is important. So national or nationalist movements should also borrow from, you know, other, like, more, how do you call it, more focused or targeted movements. And then that way, so intranationally,
mm-hmm.
Cross-pollinating, then across borders, and then hopefully across regions, across and continents.
I like the way you frame that, because mm-hmm. I think that one of the challenges for me, especially with End Femicide, and the co-option that I saw when the protests happened, because the protests that happened, the Reject Finance Bill, they mm-hmm. used the End Femicide blueprint, mm-hmm. which was, we had not seen countywide protests that organized, that well done in, not in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that. And I think one of the challenges for me was trying to see and trying to watch the End Femicide organizers and movement builders, because this has been a movement that's been there since
2019,
mm-hmm. you know, watching them engage with the Reject Finance Bill protests, you know, and you know, the range of those protests and those protesters and those organizers, and do it from a point of, hey, by the way. And I actually, I remember watching this and I was telling somebody, I'm like, this is going to end badly. I was like, first of all, because we could see the misogyny come up, and the state was very, very deliberate and intentional about feeding and stoking misogynistic influencers during the protests. And then secondly, because I felt like a lot of the End Femicide movement builders weren't taking their rightful place. They were there like, they were using the ethos that we use for African feminist work in a space that wasn't feminist, you know? And so they're coming in and they're like, we're sharing the space, and you're sharing the space with somebody who hasn't done a quarter of the work you've done and wants to engage with you as an equal partner. And so, of course, it, you know, it was having a lot of conflict. And I felt, and I still do actually, that it's important for movements to retain their independent identities.
Yes.
So, End Femicide, organize and come into protest as End Femicide, because you have an issue that is, again, going to be on the agenda for whatever this larger protest is. And then you're able to actually build alliances or not. Because I think one of the things we discovered was that there were people in the broader protest movement who were like, we don't care what your End Femicide agenda is. Actually, we are against that agenda. And it took, I think it also took people aback, because they were like, oh, let's try and bridge this gap. And I'm like, no. Once somebody says you're not human, there's no gap to bridge. You know, just pull out. Pull out, you know. So I think that framing is super important, that it is important that movements are engaging with each other, but also that you're giving movements a chance to build independent identities and not always lending your labor. Maybe this is a message for African feminists and Kenyan feminists in particular. We're not always lending our labor to things where we then have to negotiate our worth after we've done the work, right? You know, I'm not knocking this BBC documentary. I'm sure you've watched it on the protests. Mm-hmm. And it's a fascinating piece of work, and especially in terms of really laying the blame at the door of the state for the violence. But it erases women's contributions to the protests almost completely. Mm. It frames the protests as this male young protagonist and this old man. Mm-hmm. Like, we're back to this patriarchal order. That was all from movements need to, they need to cross-pollinate. Mm. They need not to be subsumed and basically owned by others, especially, I think, because movements now are also very episodic, which is just a function, again, of all these intersecting things. So, and I know we get blamed for this a lot, but people engage when and if they can.
Yes.
Right? So you can't be on Twitter saying, how come you guys aren't complaining about, you know, this horrible situation? It's like, okay, right now, I just don't have the bandwidth to do it, right? And we kind of don't collectively have the bandwidth to do it.
And that's, it's by design,
It's by design.
It is by design. So I know that people dislike semantic debates, but that's why I like, you know, very specific
That's why
language.
We have conversations.
Exactly.
Though. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so people are being impoverished, you know? And it's like poverty across multiple...
Yeah.
Across multiple spheres, you know, including time, resources, energy.
Yes.
And one of my pet subjects that's very unpopular at the moment is a decline or just non-existence of third spaces, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's mostly young people that will suffer from this because of the correlation of, you know, youth and income or earnings.
Yes.
But then now, of course, because of polycrisis, people are poorer longer, right? Which then affects their, you know, like their not just class mobility, income mobility.
Yeah.
I haven't forgotten this interview that happened. I think it was Larry Madowo that did it during the 2024 Maandamano. And one of the gentlemen he interviewed spoke about being unable to marry, like, and, you know, it might sound like a passing comment, but it's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have, I like to talk about my generation being stuck in arrested development, which, not the show, the state, the psychological state. But yes, creating a group of people that don't move across rights.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we become, we are anomalous even in our society.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We are anomalous. So in your family, they're going to ask you, why aren't you doing these things that are expected of you, but with what money, with what resources, with what opportunities?
Yep.
So you don't have the third spaces, you're not able to contribute meaningfully as a member of society. This, you know, trickles down. We have women authors, mostly, of course, in the United States, who've written about how this has started manifesting in women specifically when it comes to substance use disorders. Mm-hmm. And this renders entire populations... You know, like, it kills women, it kills people. And this is hailed as some kind of social victory because women cannot participate in this one sphere, right? to the same extent as men. so this is, you know, that's one way, yeah? Because it's something that I've noted with great concern. Unhealthy coping mechanisms that women are going to have or tend to have, that are still stigmatized, by the way.
Right.
Because
they're trying to cope.
Exactly. It's not something nobody's going to clap for people for having substance use disorders, for example.
No.
And then now you add this to the more visible, but then, like, we still haven't managed to connect them when we talk about things like maternal mortality because of, you know, the withdrawal of US aid. Funding,
but also just the conditions of living
exactly
that make your, you know, your pregnancy more precarious
exactly
right
and then the constant threat of violence
the
constant threat of violence which I really want people to internalize that frame that it is the state that allows it is the state. There's no violence that's happening somewhere that cannot be correlated to the government
or the
state specifically and the government exists to run the state so we have to, at the end, like, when we point fingers up, you know.
Yeah. No. I always say, I don't want us to point up. Remember, again, 2010 Constitution. We the people, right?
Yes.
Sovereignty flows this way.
Mm.
So I think one of the things is to start, and I think this is why the protests were so powerful, and we've talked about this, right? How there are sort of this hope infusion for you. And it's because people started to say, much louder than they have ever said, you're not working for us the way we want you to.
Exactly.
And you don't get to decide that you, whatever you decide to do is for our benefit without us.
Yes.
Right? That demand for accountability for me was a reflexive use of political activism in a way that I think has really scared the state.
Yes.
I also think that that's why infanticide protests are effective. And again, to go back to how do we survive these sort of intersecting crises, you've got to find a mechanism and a tool where the state responds to your demands.
Yes.
And so if institutions aren't going to work, if they're going to be de-escalated, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, we have this whole conversation. We had by-elections in Kenya on the 27th of November. Enormous amount of state violence. We have not had a proper statement from IEBC on violence.
Yes.
Right? So this institution that is responsible, the electoral body that is funded and responsible, is let off the hook. Right? And IEBC would have been saying, here's our statement. These are our responsibility. These are our responsibilities as we see them. Mm-hmm. These are the ways that we believe the National Police Service failed us or should have acted and did not act, another institution. So we're having this whole conversation now in Kenya that's become about goonism.
Yes.
Where's the state? The state's disappeared.
Yes.
Right? Again, what
the
you're...
The state sanctions this.
And the state sanctions, either sanctions... or is the sponsor of that violence,
yes.
Or by its incompetence has facilitated that
exactly.
violence. Like, it's one of those three. And in each one of those instances, the state should be able to then say, hey, this, we're sorry about our incompetence in this case. We will do better in 1, 2, 3 ways. Mm. But the failure of the state to do that is a concession about the violence, right?
Yes.
So I think it's, and I do think that that point about violence is super important, because it also brings me back to something that you've talked about that I think is something that we should maybe close on, which is, you know, how does this violence live in our bodies, right? And how does this state of pathology, because it's also pathology, right? Like, it's not normal to be living in so many, with, in a context that is being defined as crisis ridden.
Yes.
Like, that is not normal. So what is that doing to us? What is it supposed to do to us? And how do we as African feminists, you know, work around, think around, be around, or out of that state?
I think it is supposed to make us despondent. At least that's the intended goal. And I'll speak as someone who they managed to make despondent for a very long time.
Yes.
Marilyn knows that. I remember, was it in 2017 where I declared
yes.
that I will not be attending any more protests that have to do with democracy.
Yeah.
Because I was walloped. We were walloped really badly in 2016. And I was so offended because I think we were fewer than 50 people
mm-hmm.
At a protest in town being chased around by the police. As people closed.
Yes, as closed their shops. Yes.
I was so offended.
Yeah.
So after that, I think I remember telling you that the only protests I will be attending
yes.
are women's marches.
Yep.
Yeah. And then after that, ended up, you know, going for grad school, living abroad for some time, and then coming back, you know, freshly disillusioned in 2023 and spending that year basically just floating like a kind of, you know, just,
mm-hmm.
I don't even know, like a leaf just in the air. Just, if you've ever seen
watching.
A leaf just, you know,
yeah.
floating around. And this, I just want to end on this like note of hope. Until Cairns did their big one last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not, you know, I don't know how to explain to people. I thought I was going to die before I saw what we saw last year.
Mm-hmm.
I used to tell people, oh, you know, only the French are capable.
Yes, I remember you telling me this.
I used to tell
yes.
everybody, oh, yes. no, only yeah. the French are capable of, you know, that kind of, like, theater, that protest. And so we did infanticide last year. And I was like,
2024.
2024, yes. Yeah, last year.
Oh, yeah, it's last year. Yeah. Oh, my God, it feels like this has been
so
2 years.
So we did it,
oh,
and it was like yes. an injection of hope. But then, I've always
yes.
believed in
yeah.
Kenyan women and Kenyan feminists, to
yes.
be specific.
Yes.
So that was nothing new,
mm-hmm.
right? The skill was amazing. But
yes.
I was, you know,
yeah.
this is a big problem, right?
Yep.
And we've been organizing these marches for quite some time,
mm-hmm.
right? With fluctuating levels of participation, but still, they
yes.
have been happening, yep. and the conversation has been happening. Then we did our big one as Kenyans. Wow. And you know, initially, like, I'll I'll just walk you through how it played out in my head. On the 18th of June, there was a protest, but then I was like, I was still holding my, this one, they're going to go, yes. They're going to be 50 of them in town. Mm-hmm. They're going to be beaten.
Yep.
Yeah. They're going to eat the amount of tear gas they're going to eat. They're going to regret their lives. But then the turnout was quite okay. And then I keep telling people I relapsed. So on the, on the 20th of June, mm-hmm. I went out. I was like, I was just so energized. And then on the 22nd, I think 22nd, I was also there because we were having, they were ruling.
Yep.
The one that I wasn't able to make it for and that shocked me, completely blew me away was the one on the 25th because I was repelled. We were repelled in Upper Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And had to be stuck there. And that's when I knew things had changed. Kenyans injected, you know, the way Kenyans like saying inject on social media. They injected hope into my veins. Now I'm going to die, right?
Yeah.
And that's how I knew it was different. And just to give context, I've been writing about Kenyan politics for, I think, 15 years now.
Yep.
So this for me is outstanding. That's how I know we have crossed the Rubicon.
Yes. Yeah.
When it comes to, you know, things we will and will not accept. So I have a really hopeful stance, a hopeful posture. I think the energy is there. The goodwill is there. It's about shaping it. And this is why I was telling Marilyn, this is my first quote-unquote media appearance since I closed my own podcast or since it went on hiatus in 2019. That's how hopeful I am.
I love that.
I'm back,
Yes.
Like, commenting and, you know, trying to shape the conversation.
Yes.
And for me, it's not as a kind of priest or a kind of, you know,
mm-hmm.
pontificator. No, it's as a, it's a comrade, right?
Yes.
This is what I can do. It's what I can share. I have the training, the information. I've been doing this for a bit of time. So have you. And, you know, to just help participate in that conversation, one. And hopefully build structures under all this momentum because we're moving really fast.
Yes.
Yeah, we're moving really, really fast. And we stand or we run the risk of being ahistorical or forgetting some of our wins and pausing to celebrate our wins.
Yeah.
Because these people don't like us. Power does not like us thinking we are winning.
Yeah.
Like they do not like to concede. Yeah.
Yeah.
They do not like to concede.
I think that's a great place to sort of to pause because I think we're going to have this conversation again. I think it's both a powerful place because of the hope that you talk about, but also because of the power of protest, especially now when there is this really deliberate attempt to delegitimize protest as a means of, you know, democracy and political participation, right? And as long, I'm going to keep saying this, as long as you make institutions unworkable and as long as institutions are failing, people will resort to protest.
And
which
they
is,
they must.
And they should, right? And so I think maybe what we're also saying is, as African feminists, the tools that we have already discovered that work, protests. Mm-hmm. We've refined over periods of years. In Kenya, we've refined them. In South Africa, we're sharing lessons across the continent. And we're also learning, especially from Latin America. I still remember the Rapist Is You, right? The performance that was done here. And agenda setting.
Yes.
And I think, you know, it's an important reminder about living in crisis does not also mean that you don't have joy.
Yes.
Right? Because you have joy in the midst of crisis. You have joy, you have celebration, you have wins. Not because you're done, but because even along the way, you know, these are markers. These are important markers.
Yes.
And if we are not more deliberate, I think, about doing that. I love how we marked them this year, the protests this year. And I hope that that's going to be something that we continue to do in Kenya.
Yes.
But thank you, everyone, for joining us in our conversation.
Thank you.
Brenda and I have been in conversation with each other for, gosh, over a decade now, right?
Yeah.
We like to say we're an example of intergenerational feminism in its purest form. So this conversation on polycrisis and African feminisms, again, is an introductory conversation. It's one that we hope that we will continue to have and that offers frames of thinking about crises as African feminists and for people interested in African feminism. So thank you so much for joining us.